that is not necessary any longer. We've got prisons that can secure the community, and we have clear evidence of racism from top to bottom. So we shouldn't have something that is as irrevocable as executions.
Do you think the current administration or the cultural moment will could force that reckoning?
So, you know, the Biden administration has said, they've come out and said that they're against the death penalty. I don't think our legislatures are anywhere near ready to pass an abolition bill. We, you know, they can't even pass the sun rising in the east. So I don't think we can expect any kind of a bombshell.
Nothing bipartisan is on the way.
Yeah, I don't think that's going to happen. But there are some things that the Biden administration can do. They can take people off of death row. They cannot execute. They cannot seek the death penalty. And we're cautiously optimistic that the Biden administration is moving in the right direction.
From another angle, it does make me wonder about your thoughts about the, I shudder to bring this up, but the current Supreme Court. Do you see, as cases move up to this particular set of folks, them taking on that ethical question of racism and the death penalty?
No, the death penalty fight has moved to a state-by-state battle. And no one in my world thinks that it is reasonable that the United States Supreme Court, as presently constituted, is going to find the death penalty unconstitutional. You know, I think it's important to be realistic in the work that we do, and it is realistic to think that state by state we're going to win this battle to the point where it will be unconstitutional because our standards of decency have evolved, where the United States Supreme Court will have no choice but to say enough states have gotten rid of this at this point. It's not part of our standards of decency any longer. So that's a ways off, but state by state, we're winning this battle. And I think for good reason, as I've said.
Well, it's one of the points that you make is that it's so overrepresented. I mean, states like Texas and Oklahoma, I don't know if it's the right way to say it, but they seem to love the death penalty.
The death penalty is being condensed into a small number of counties. So you're right about that. There are some states are going to be the last ones to get the message. It's kind of like Juneteenth, where Texas didn't find out about it, you know, or, well, African Americans in Texas didn't find out about it anyway. Who knows who did know about it? But yeah, Texas, Alabama, Oklahoma, they'll be the last ones to get this message that we've moved on from this punishment. But I think a lot of states are thinking about it now. Even Utah is very seriously considering ending the death penalty there. It, you know, even for conservative people, and we haven't talked about the morality of the death penalty. At some point, I wouldn't mind getting to that. But even for conservative people, for fiscally responsible people, you know, Oregon has only executed two people in 55 years. They were both volunteers. And by volunteers, I mean they gave up their appeals. They didn't want to fight it any longer. So for all intents and purposes, Oregon's death penalty is symbolic only. Pennsylvania has only executed three people in 60 years. All of them gave up their appeals. So, you know, when we look at these states with their symbolic death penalty, we're spending a lot of money and we're getting nothing for it. So even conservatives are going to start thinking, why are we spending this money that could be so much better spent somewhere else? So I think we're going to win this battle for a lot of different reasons.
Well, it sounds like you're circling back to the morality question about, since we have all the statistics, it comes around to, again, that it's vengeance. It has to be for, right, to take a moral stance that if this is done, this must be done in return. Isn't that what we're left with?
So I like to tell this story. I think it maybe it dates me a little bit. I don't really think it does, because I think it's still around. It's the story of the Lion King. And so, you know, I watched the Lion King a lot with my kids when they were younger, the animated version I'm talking about. And if you think about the story of the Lion King, you've got Mufasa, who is this great leader, a beneficent kind of leader of the pride. And then you've got Scar, who is a heinous criminal. And Scar commits this very awful crime. He intentionally murders Mufasa, and he does it for horrible motives, because he wants to run the pride himself. And then he compounds the crime by basically framing Simba, the son of Mufasa, and he persuades Simba that he's responsible for his father's death. And Simba grows up with this awful guilt about what he did to his father. And then Simba grows up and he confronts Scar. And in what passes for a lion trial, they tumble in the dirt, and Simba ends up on top of Scar. And Scar says, "What are you going to do now, Simba? Are you going to kill me?" And I stopped the tape, and I asked my six-year-old, who is now older than six, what she thought Simba should do. And she said, "Well, it's not nice to kill people, even if they're mean." And so you think to yourself, and Simba ultimately says, "I'm not like you, Scar," and he banishes him from the pride. Scar then tumbles to his death because he doesn't accept the punishment. But that's where the analogy ends, because Scar does not accept his punishment. But imagine if Simba said, "Yes, Scar, I'm going to kill you. I'm going to strap you to a gurney and inject poison in your veins until you're dead." Every little kid watching that movie would go screaming out of the theaters, and parents would sue the Walt Disney Company, right, for trauma. And so, you know, it's so obvious to kids and to parents that we don't want our heroes acting like a heinous murderer acts. And yet we've got prosecutors all the time saying, "Show this person, the defendant, the same mercy he showed the victim. Act as a jury in the same heinous, horrible way the defendant acted." And so somewhere between the age of six and the age of, you know, adulthood, whenever that adulthood is, we lose sight of the fact that we shouldn't be acting like a heinous murderer acts, that we want our heroes to be better than that. And so the moral question for me has always been a pretty easy one. You know, we shouldn't be acting that way. We should be acting better. And that, you know, the Lion King resolves the moral question for me.
It also brings up one of my thoughts about one essay that you say specifically about prosecutorial misconduct, that there's a thread that goes through the cases that relates to human compassion, humanizing the convicted person, the full human story of their lives, and that one of the strongly used techniques is to keep mitigating information out of the sentencing. Can you talk some more about that?
There's a reason that jurors don't get to talk with the defendant for a few hours before they make their decision. And that's because they would quickly realize that they were talking to a human being. It may be a human being who had the worst day of his life. It may be a human being who's very, very impaired or low functioning. There's many, many aspects that might dawn on jurors when they talk to someone before deciding whether they should execute them. And so the system the death penalty system doesn't allow for that, because we know that jurors would not return a death verdict, because they would realize whatever the human frailties were, they're talking to a human being. So one of the most important jobs a death penalty defense attorney has to do is to quote unquote humanize their client. Let the jury know that whatever the frailties are, this is the person in front of you, and he is in fact a human being. And of course, the other side of the aisle, the prosecutor, is doing his very best to dehumanize the client, to bring the person, the defendant, to the 15 seconds of the crime and not the full kind of panoply of this person's life. So a prosecutor has an intent to limit the mitigation in whatever way he or she can, and a defense attorney has exactly the opposite obligation, which is to let the jury know as much as possible about the person. I had a case once where we videotaped the children of the client, and the children clearly loved the client, and they said so on lengthy. They were too young to testify, but they said so in videotapes, and the prosecutor accused us of manipulation. And my response to that was, what are you talking about? Would the jury rather execute this person without knowing that he had two little children who loved him, or should they know that fact before making a life or death decision? It's not manipulation, it's information. I can't imagine there's any juror who would say, I'd rather know less about the person before I make this decision than more about the person. It's our obligation to make sure they know more.
Most of the people that are sort of high profile, none of those people receive the death penalty.
Well, certainly, I mean, when you're talking about the phrase that lawyers use is arbitrary and capricious. You can't have an arbitrary, capricious punishment. So you're putting your finger right on one of the most arbitrary aspects of the punishment. I mean, Charles Manson didn't get executed. Richard Speck didn't get executed. They got the death penalty, and then the law changed. That, you know, there's so many aspects to the arbitrariness of it. The Green River Killer didn't get the death penalty. The BTK killer did not get the death penalty. Meeting the BTK killer may not necessarily lead you to think he's more human, but it may very well show you how impaired someone like that is. And as human beings, I would like to think that we don't want to execute someone who is badly, badly impaired for any number of reasons: abandonment, neglect, organic brain damage. There's so many ways that you can be impaired, and I do believe that most jurors would not want to execute someone who is badly, badly impaired. It's not the human thing to do. But you're right. The arbitrariness of the death penalty, it can't be avoided. It's all over the place. The randomness of some poor, intellectually disabled person getting a death sentence because he has a rotten lawyer, and then someone who does a whole series of awful crimes but has lawyers that can show his mitigation in a way as to avoid the death penalty, it's pure arbitrariness. Just to stay on the kind of clickbait media coverage that we see, I often get asked a question about Ted Bundy. People like to say, what would you do with the poster child for the death penalty, Ted Bundy? And I always point out that I would have done exactly what the prosecutor did, which was offer him a life sentence. Ted Bundy didn't have to be executed. He was so impaired that he couldn't accept a life sentence, but the prosecutor offered him one. So, you know, even the poster boy for the death penalty might not have been executed. You know, just one more little fact. The death penalty has been used a number of times by people who wanted to be executed. They couldn't commit suicide, or they didn't want to commit suicide for whatever, either religious reason, or maybe they just couldn't do it. They didn't have the wherewithal to do it. But people want to be executed. I think Ted Bundy might very well have been one of those people. He certainly knew that he couldn't win the case. He couldn't win his case. He'd already been convicted a number of other times and escaped. So he wasn't going to go free. I wasn't on Ted Bundy's defense team. I just know that the prosecutor wanted to resolve the case by offering him a life sentence. And for whatever reason, he couldn't bring himself to accept that life plea. I guess my real point is, you know, even the poster boy for the death penalty could have lived. The prosecutor did not think that the death penalty was necessary to do justice in his case. The only reason he was executed is because he turned that down.
Well, you also bring up the idea of impairment, and I think really clearly in the book you bring it up in terms of severe mental illness and intellectual disability. Can you educate us a little bit on, aren't we supposed to not execute people of diminished capacity or suffering from mental illness? Is that part of our legal rubric, or am I wrong?
Well, I'm afraid that you are wrong, but barely. If you're intellectually disabled, which is a phrase that for most of your listeners, I think, will know, but it used to be called mental retardation. Now we refer to it as intellectual disability. So if you're intellectually disabled, you're not eligible for the death penalty. And if you're under 18 when you commit your crime, you're not eligible for the death penalty. One state, and I think it's only one state, has barred the death penalty for someone who is severely mentally ill, and that is Ohio. But you are still eligible for the death penalty if you are severely mentally ill. In fact, Andre Thomas, the man I referred to earlier, who had taken out both of his eyes, and I hate to be graphic about it, but I think it's important in this context, he ate his second eyeball because he was afraid the government would put it back in his head. That's how mentally ill he was and is. We can still execute someone who is severely mentally ill. The biggest hurdle I think we have is defense attorneys not doing the necessary job to make sure that the jury knows all about the person's mental illness. In the Andre Thomas case, the lawyers just did not do a good job of bringing that evidence in front of the jury so that the jury could make an informed decision. A lot of the mental illness evidence just wasn't brought to the jury. And, you know, I think this country still has a problematic skepticism with mental illness. We see it as soft science as opposed to hard science. And, I think 50 years from now, we'll look back at our knowledge of mental illness, you know, the same way we look back at putting leeches on, you know, on bodies for illness sake. We just don't know. We don't have enough knowledge of mental illness right now, and many people are skeptical of it in an absurd way, I think.
I agree. So just to pivot a little bit, at the Atlantic Center for Capital Representation, do you help train young lawyers around these?
Thank you for asking me about the Atlantic Center for Capital Representation, because I tend to get wound up and forget about that. I would encourage your listeners to go to atlanticcenter.org to get a good sense of what we do. Just to answer your question, we do a lot of trainings across the state and frankly across the country. I teach pretty routinely at various conferences, and we consult with capital defense teams across the state and across the country as well. That's an important part of what the Atlantic Center does.
So kind of tying into that, my question is, do you see the younger generation taking on the mantle of capital punishment from a different perspective? Like how is their culture affecting how they hold these questions?
So for years, I tried to persuade young lawyers that capital punishment was not a career path. I was naively convinced that we would get rid of it, and that they should not be, you know, spending years preparing for something that was going to go away. And then a couple of elections got in our way. I'm thinking Bush, Gore, and then 2016, and I won't even mention that.
One of the things that I noticed at the end of the last administration was that there seemed to be an intentional upsurge in executions at the end of the last administration. Did you have something you wanted to add about that?
I think that when we see the steep decline in the death penalty, and we are seeing it, we're seeing a decline in death sentences and we're seeing a decline in executions. And I think based on that, you know, right-thinking people can forget about the issue or be lackadaisical about it, not pay close attention. And so when an administration comes along, really a lawless administration, and I'm not afraid to say that the Trump administration was lawless, they went and executed 13 people in 7 months, a historic record of executions. And with the Department of Justice's assent in a lot of lawless behavior. And so all I want to say about it is it's important for us to be vigilant. You know, while I'm cautiously optimistic that this punishment is going to go away, and I firmly believe it will, that doesn't mean we're not going to have a lot of casualties before it does go away. And so I think for right-thinking people, I'm hoping that they will continue to be vigilant on this issue. And so, you know, now we need a younger generation to kind of pick up the mantle. I think that we're much more attuned to race discrimination, as we talked about earlier. I think the younger generation is more sensitive to mental illness. You know, all the things that we've learned over these last decades, and then really the last 4, 5, 10 years, I think should be brought to bear and will be brought to bear by a younger generation of death penalty lawyers. And I you know, I may have been naive to think it would be gone by now, but the trend is clear. And it's going to be gone, whether it's in my lifetime or not, it will be gone, and so the next generation might bring that home.
Yeah, you say at the end of your book, the web of capital punishment is wide but thin, and those fighting against it are close to breaking through. So I guess that's my last question: is what makes you hopeful right now?
Well, let me just say this. I mean, the state of Virginia, it's that's a Confederate state. They executed more people historically than any other state in the country, more than Texas. They were a state longer than Texas, but they executed more people than Texas. They got rid of the death penalty. A state like Utah, a blood atonement state, is thinking seriously about getting rid of the death penalty. So it's impossible for me not to be cautiously optimistic that we're about to break through when we have successes like Virginia and Utah. And of course, it's a two steps forward and one step back situation. I know that there are some people in Virginia that are thinking about reinstating it now, and you're always going to see Nebraska got rid of it, and then the governor went and brought it back. You're always going to see that two steps forward and one step back situation. But the two steps forward are controlling right now. And so it's going to happen, and it really is just a question of when.
Just a little more specifically, you're saying state by state, you think it'll be given up and then it would be federally a change in policy? Or
at some point, you know, things change because we change. And, you know, all you have to do is look at gay marriage to see how quickly the population perspective changed. You know, over a decade, we really changed our evaluation of that public policy. And so as states get rid of the death penalty, the public policy changes. And so, you know, if the death penalty is in a discrete minority of cases, then a challenge in the United States Supreme Court will be ripe. With intellectual disability, a number of states said, we're not executing intellectually disabled people. And then juveniles came along, and a number of states said, we're not executing juveniles. And the United States Supreme Court looked at those decisions and said, there's enough states that have said, we can't do this anymore, so that it violates our evolving standards of decency. Eventually, we're going to have enough states say that, so that the death penalty is going to violate our evolving standards of decency.
That's a nice place to stop on. So thanks so much.
Thank you. Uh-huh. It's been great. Thank you.
Thank you. You're listening to KBOO Portland.